Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join us as we go diving into the big old boxes and binders and wherever you store your baseball cards, the collection of cardboard, as we relive some childhood memories, some fond memories, maybe some not so fond memories of some of the cards you had as a kid. And we've got some mostly fond memories with the set that we're looking at today. Our listeners selected an 83 Topps cello pack to break into, and you can watch the video link of that pack break on YouTube. Just type in Wax Ecstatic on YouTube. You'll get directed to that. Or just look into our Wax and Gum Stains timeline on Twitter, and you'll see the link from yesterday. As we didn't land any of the big fish from 83 Topps, those, of course, the holy trinity of rookies from 1983, Wade Boggs, Ryan Sandberger, Tony Gwynn. However, quite a few Hall of Famers, including three in a row in the pack, as we got Alan Trammell and Tim Raines and Mike Schmidt all in a row. Also, Bruce Sutter was in there as well. And some pretty good cards, and also, unfortunately, three dreaded manager cards. All good managers, but still, when you're going through the pack, you know, you only have 28 cards in that pack. And no disrespect to the late, great Dick Houser and Ralph Houk and Tony La Russa, but come on. That's not the holy trinity of cards that I'm looking for in my pack. But despite the lack of the big rookies, we got some Hall of Famers in there. And also some other interesting stories, which we will get to in this podcast. Now, how did we get to 83 Topps? Well, we posted on Wax and Gum Stains the poll this past Monday. We offered up a cello pack of 82 Topps, the cello pack of 83 Topps, and the rack pack of 85 Donruss. And I said that this would be a very tough choice to make. I pointed that out in the last podcast. And it was a very tightly contested race, especially early on. The fans of 85 Donruss, and there are plenty of you, got the vote in early and took the lead. But then slowly but surely, 83 takes over and would ultimately win the vote with 49% of the votes. 85 Donruss getting 33% and 82 Topps getting a respectable 18%. I'm not surprised at all that 83 Topps was the winner in that race there. And it was kind of fun watching the numbers go back and forth and ultimately seeing 83 Topps come out on top, because we haven't done a pack break on 83 Topps in quite a while. So we were able to do that and had a lot of fun pulling those cards out. And also the scratch-off ticket that was in there. We're going to talk a little bit about that on the podcast as well. First, a little bit of housekeeping. If you enjoy Wax Ecstatic, then follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Make sure you tell your friends about the podcast and the Twitter feed as well, as the Twitter feed is open 24/7 for your conversation on all things dealing with the hobby, whether it's classic cards or current cards, or, you know, maybe cards you have in your collection you're looking to sell or trade. You know, we've had lots of conversations about that. And if you have any questions about the podcast or any of the cards or sets or players we talk about, you can always post them at Wax and Gum Stains as well. Now, during the off-season, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. So today is November 16th. Our next podcast will come your way on Friday, November the 30th. And I believe we'll have another pack break to look at with that one as well. So look for a look for a poll to come out on Twitter on Monday, November 26th, and then we'll have a video of the break on the 29th, and like I said, the podcast on the 30th. So the last week of November, a busy one for us, as we will cover all of that for you. And probably, I think we're at a point now where the packs that have not been selected in previous elections will get cobbled together. And we'll be opening up several of them down the stretch here. And I know we'll be talking about some sets that we've already discussed recently, but I think it'll be more of an issue of, you know, what do we actually pull out of these sets that will be, or pull out of these packs that will be the topic of conversation for a lot of these upcoming shows here. Now, if you would like to help facilitate Wax Ecstatic in a couple of ways, one, keeping the channel alive on our home base of Audio Boom and all of our subsequent partners in getting the podcast out, that would be iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify, then you can make a cash donation at Wax Ecstatic via PayPal. PayPal.me/Wax Ecstatic. Just type that into your browser, PayPal.me/Wax Ecstatic. And you can make a personal donation, even if it's just a few bucks, $5, you know, if you got that handy. That goes right into the program, maintaining it, again, on Audio Boom and all the channels that it feeds. And it also goes into the purchase of packs that we open up here. And while I've got my eye on several older packs, I'm trying to win a few bids on some late 70s packs I think would be fun to open up. I haven't had much luck with that. I've been outbid in the last second. You know how eBay works. I've been outbid in the last second on a few of these, so still trying. But as always, any cash contributions will go right back to the program, not only for maintenance of the site, but also in purchasing of the packs. So yeah, we will be recycling some packs, if you will, over the next few weeks. But if I can be lucky and get my hands on some packs at the right price, and I think they'll be entertaining for the program, then we will go ahead and do that. I will be making a trip out to the local card show this weekend, so cross my fingers, we'll find something decent there as well. And I've had some interesting near purchases. I've had to think long and hard about some of them. I saw on eBay a box of, 91 Top Stadium Club. I think it was Series 2. And the big card in Series 2, I believe, is the Jeff Bagwell rookie. And I love Stadium Club in 91. That was the set that finally, in 1991, topped the bar that was set by Upper Deck. And I think after Stadium Club, that really set the tone, not only for the premium cards, because you saw some companies dabble in the premium card, you know, Leaf coming out with a nice little set here, and there were others that were attempting to be the, you know, the bar setters with Upper Deck. But Stadium Club really did that. And then not only did the premium sets have their bars set, but everybody else, you know, the base sets were suddenly premium-like, you know, in 1992. And I thought, wow, I can get a box of Stadium Club from 91. I think it was like $11. It was ridiculously cheap. And I was going to buy it. And I may still circle back and see if that seller's putting him up there. But, you know, the Stadium Club, the problem is, and we've discussed this before, the UV coating in the Stadium Club cards are not very kind 25 plus years later, as they tend to stick together there. So I'm like, well, do I want to pay $11 to basically unstick bricks of baseball cards in my spare time? And I thought better of it. Maybe not. But that's what I'm, you know, out there looking for, trying to find some packs from the 70s that we can get at a good price, trying to find some early 80s stuff, trying to find some gems from the junk wax era as well, and have some fun things for us to open up and look at future shows. And again, we could use your help if you have a few extra bucks at Wax Ecstatic. Again, paypal.me/Wax Ecstatic. And if you have already made a donation, thank you very much. Your donations have kept the show going here throughout the last several months. Now, speaking of wax and gum stains, I did have one comment from the timeline that I do want to pass along from earlier this week. And it was from Where's Vicky? That's the name on the account here. And let me see if I can get the handle here. Mark Frick, 1962. Writes in, just found the podcast, love it. Speaking of card sets with boring designs, now this would be in the response to the 83 Donruss packs we opened up a couple weeks ago. Speaking of card sets with boring designs, how about some love for my favorite run, Hostess, from 1975 to 1979. Yeah, those were some boring cards. For those who don't know, Hostess, one of many companies that did have the blessing of Major League Baseball to produce cards that used word marks and logos. And basically, this was the sides of boxes of Hostess products, so Twinkies in particular, and you know all the other Hostess products from the 70s, Ho-Hos and Ding Dongs and Snowballs and all those things. You know, basically the back panel of the box that carried those tremendously sweet and diabetes-inducing treats that we all know and love from our childhood. They would post a stack full of cards, like a sheet of cards. I think there were three or four on the back of the boxes here. And if you were a kid and you managed to buy the box of Twinkies that weren't crumpled by the stock boy at the local A&P, then you could very carefully cut these out and stick them in your shoebox with all your other cards, wrap them up with rubber bands. And a lot of those cards, even though they were boring, there is still some value to them. First of all, because of the thing that I just mentioned, the condition. A lot of the times, they did have rubber bands around them, or they were just tossed in a shoebox and not very well taken care of, not cut out very nice and neat. And let's be honest, you know, if you're 8 years old and it's 1978 and you've just polished off a box of Twinkies, you're not exactly going to your X-Acto knife and very meticulously slicing out these cards on the back of your Twinkies box. No, you're just grabbing some scissors, or maybe you're just tearing them up by hand and you're just adding them to your collection. Or, you know, maybe you take the whole panel and you thumbtack it to your bedroom wall, you know, something like that. So finding the Hostess cards from the 70s in great shape is kind of hard to do, because we're also talking about a different cardboard stock too. It wasn't the slightly stronger cardboard grade that you saw Topps make baseball cards in the 70s. It was cardboard box. It was meant to hold Twinkies, not to stand the test of time. But also, there is some value to some of these cards, because there's quite a class of players that they printed cards for. And it's interesting when you look at the checklist of some of the Hostess cards. I mean, you've got like 1979 Ozzie Smith. You know, it's essentially a Hostess rookie card for a future Hall of Famer. So you've got some quality players from those sets. So even though the mid to late 70s Hostess cards are indeed boring, there wasn't very much inspiration put into the design of these things, there is some value to them, and there are some people who did collect them and maintain them in pretty good shape. So yeah, just a quick glance at some of those cards. They're not very appealing to the eye, but if you are up for a challenge of finding a set of cards that were very hard to find in good shape even back then, and certainly 40 years later, you can also find a pretty good class of players that were included in those Hostess sets. So there's scarcity, and there's a good, you know, class of especially rookie players from that time that may be worth your while in tracking some of those down. And on the flip side of the coin, because they are just Hostess cards and not exactly, you know, 75 Topps mini cards that are much more in demand, you can still find these relatively scarce Hostess cards at decent prices. You got to look around for them. But you know, thank you very much for the question there, as they are indeed boring, but you know, nothing to sneeze at here. It is an interesting collection to go after if you have the time, money, and patience to track down those cards from 40 plus years ago from the backs of the Hostess Twinkie boxes. Now, we also had a lot of discussion when we put the poll up regarding this week's pack break. You know, which one do you choose? And we had a lot of commentary about 85 Donruss, which we did a pack break on several weeks ago. And there's no doubt that 85 Donruss is a gem from the 1980s and is arguably the best set that Donruss put out, a crowning achievement just 5 years after the real clunker of a premiere set in 81. But also, you know, 82 Tops, some people say they like it, others say, eh, whatever. And 82 Tops was the last of a stretch of sets that Tops put out that I consider to be good but not great. And I think that stretch starts in 79. You have 79, you have 80, you have 81, you have 82, all good but not great cards, mostly sets that are saved by big rookie cards. 79, of course, is Ozzie Smith. 80, Ricky Henderson. 81, you're looking at Tim Raines, Kirk Gibson, and then, of course, 82, you have the Cal Ripken rookie with the three-player panel, and the 82 top set would correct itself with the update set where Ripken had his own card, albeit later on in the season in a separate set. So Tops, and I think part of the problem with Tops during this time was with all the litigation going on, and they knew that there would be competition, namely in Fleer, and Donruss kind of came in through the back door in the summer of 1980. But I don't think Topps really knew what the competition was going to put out. But as we've pointed out in previous podcasts, what they did know was that they owned the market. They had owned the market for 25 years by the time Fleer and Donruss came around. And they owned the wholesale angle. They owned the hobby shop angle. They had the top salespeople in the the business, and they also had the legendary status. You know, if you were a kid in 1981 collecting baseball cards, chances are your dad collected baseball cards. Maybe your uncle collected baseball cards, and your brothers, your sisters, everybody in your family collected baseball cards. Well, if they collected in the previous 25 years, it was Topps they were collecting. So just name recognition, a legacy status, that helped Topps out. So while they were trying to figure out what was the competition putting out, Topps could basically put out a safe and, you know, very basic baseball card. And that's what they did during that four-year stretch. So again, good. You know, these are not terrible cards that they put out, but certainly not great, and certainly not after that stretch of outstanding baseball cards that they put out in the 70s. And I look back at 71 through 78 as just this glorious stretch of baseball card history, but often underrated, I think. People kind of get hung up on the cards of the 50s and 60s. You look back at 71 through 78, and even though, like, the 72 set is garish, even though some people don't like the 74 set, although I'm perfectly fine with that, I like 74 Tops. You look back, you know, the Black Border 71 set. You look back at, you know, the multicolor 75 set. Yeah, it's a little tacky, but it's iconic. And I really think some of the best sets that still don't quite get the love they deserve, 76, 77, 78, you look back at those. Boy, Topps had such a great stretch of cards in the 1970s, and in particular that mid to late 70s stretch. So when you look back, hindsight being 2020, and you look back at what was put out between 79 and 82, you kind of go, yeah, it was a little bit of a lull there. But in 1983, man, Topps put it together. And they had a little bit of help from a set that they released 20 years before. If you have a 1963 Topps card, take it, hold it side by side with a card from 1983, and the comparisons are quite easy to see. You look at the 83 Topps card from the front, you've got a little bit of a white border. About 75% of the card is dedicated to mostly action shots. Sometimes you have a stage shot, but it's mostly action shots. And then in one of the lower corners, you've got this little circular mugshot, if you will, the headshot of the player, and that's normally posed. And the 83 Topps cards have a full color headshot. That is, it's basically just a cropped picture pasted there. Topps would kind of do a similar treatment to the 84 set, but instead of having the natural background behind the player's head, they had a color background that was coordinated with the color of the lettering on the cards. But 83 Topps, would utilize a very similar design to 1963, where you had mostly an act, or not an action shot, but you had a large stage shot in the background, a head shot in the lower corner, and then you would have the player's name and position and team name in the other corner. So striking similarities. I don't know if Topps purposely said, let's find a classic design and kind of manipulate it a little bit and turn it into something new for 1983. But I don't think it's coincidence that precisely 20 years later, this nice round number later, Topps comes up with a design that is strikingly similar to what they had put out before, and it was extremely successful. Now, the backs of the cards from 1983 to 63 differ a little bit, but let's focus on 83. When you flip it over, Topps giving it the horizontal treatment as they had done ever since 1973 and would continue to do so until 1993. And the backs of the 83 Topps cards are very easy to read. It was a very nice change from 1982. Remember, 82, you have the gray cardstock, the dark green background. It was the last year that Topps would employ the dark green ink, which they apparently hoarded in the 70s. They utilized dark green a lot on the backs of the cards in the 70s. But they had the dark green background and the blue, purple, black, you know, there's this very dark color of text. And it was very hard to read, and especially if you had a print run that was either slightly darker than a previous one, or maybe there was a little smudge in the printing. Very hard to read the details on the back of an 82 Topps card. Not the case in 83, as you have the gray cardstock, but a light orange treatment with the black text, a lot easier to read. So 83 Topps, from a design standpoint, perhaps inspired by 63 Topps, an instant classic, by far the class of all the cards that came out in 1983. And for Topps, it was perfect timing, because as we discussed in our last program, Donruss was finally starting to go in the right direction. 83 Donruss was a slight improvement over 82, but by 84, Donruss really had it going in the right direction. And then, of course, by 1985, they produced their best set and produced some pretty good sets throughout the remainder of the 1980s. Fleer certainly did find the right direction in 1983, started their first of a string of what I call the business sets. You know, very conservative but clean, classy looks to their cards. They would have the dual picture feature on the back of their cards in 1983, the first time for three consecutive seasons that Fleer would employ that look on the back of the cards. Fleer, like Donruss, still had problems with photography quality. You still had some dark pictures, some graininess, sometimes some blurriness to the photos, so they were still working that out. But in 83, Fleer took a big step in the right direction, and then they too, like Donruss, would produce a string of great sets throughout the mid-80s, stretching into the later parts of the decade. So for Topps, whether it was inspiration from 63 or they just put it all together correctly, they hit the right chord at the right time. And then Topps would have a nice stretch of cards in the mid to late 80s. And you look back, 84 Topps, again, kind of playing off the success of 83 Topps, wildly popular. 85 Topps, a little quirky in its design, but still very popular thanks to the Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett and Mark McGwire rookie cards. 86 Topps, a love it or don't love it kind of card. You know, it's a good but not great set. And then you have the legendary 87 Topps set after that, and then some ups and downs in the late 80s and early 90s. But much like Fleer and Donruss, Topps really hitting its stride in the mid 80s, starting with that 83 set. Now, I mentioned the big cards. You've got Gwynn, you've got Sandberg, you've got Boggs in there. You also have the Cal Ripken second year card and a lot of early career cards for a lot of the great Hall of Fame players from the 1970s. And 1980s. And you also had, and we talked a little bit about this in the video, you know, in the 80s, Topps tried to outdo the competition with bonus goodies. And this is something that they started in the early 80s because for many years it was, hey, we're the only, you know, bubblegum card company that can include bubblegum. Well, as this became a hobby and a business, you know, the gum kind of got in the way. And you needed more than gum to get people to buy your product over Fleer and Donruss. So Donruss has the puzzle pieces. They have the Perez Steel Diamond King inserts, if you will, even though they were part of the base set. We'll call them inserts. Fleer, you had all the stickers being put in. Well, Topps was like, okay, we need to give away something that is not just for in the moment, like chewing a piece of gum, but we've got to give away some sweepstakes. And of course, Topps being around and being the dominant factor in baseball cards for decades at this point in time, they would work with Major League Baseball on these great prize packages. And if you grew up in the mid to late 80s, the prize package was a trip for four to spring training of the team of your choice. Now, for me, growing up in Florida, so what? You know, I would totally miss out on, you know, the round trip airfare and the hotel stay because, you know, I lived 30 minutes away from, you know, where the Phillies spring trained or where the Reds used to train and the Blue Jays and, you know, the Tigers. You know, it's like, well, big deal. But obviously, if you were living up north and, you know, you were a fan of the Reds or the Yankees or the Blue Jays or whatever, that was, you know, quite a prize. Well, before they started the spring training sweepstakes, they had World Series sweepstakes. And in the 80s, the early 80s, they did this not with an enter to win concept, but with the scratch off ticket, basically, you know, the lottery ticket. And I was looking at the insert card here. And this game in 1983, you had to rub off all spots to see how each player batted. Three of the same hit instantly wins. If the card is not an instant winner, save bonus runs for a prize. So this is what you would win. If you hit three home runs with these scratch-offs, let me see how many scratch-offs are there. There were 10 scratch-off spots. So if you hit three home runs with these scratch-offs, then you would win a trip for four to games one and two or three and four of the 1983 or 84 World Series. Now, the odds of doing this were because there were two prizes available, one in 20 million. So the odds were definitely up against you in winning a trip to one of these World Series. But if you did, and you had the choice, I've got to ask, which would you choose? Boy, that's a tough one. You know, 83, it was Phillies and Orioles. 84, it was Tigers and Padres. Now, if I knew then what I know now, and if that was the case 35 years ago, I would definitely have a different line of work. But anyways, if I knew then what I know now, me personally, I'd have to choose games one and two of the 84 World Series. Tigers, Padres, the old Tiger Stadium. Tigers would win that series in five games. It would turn out to be, you know, the last World Series the Tigers have won. And, you know, you're just thinking back, you know, to that great Tigers team that went wire to wire, started, what did they start, like 34-5 that season? You had Gibby, you had Howard Johnson, you had Chet Lemon, you had Lance Parrish, you had Whitaker and Trammell up the middle, Jack Morris, Dan Petrie, Willie Hernandez, Darrell Evans was on that team too. I mean, and then of course you've got Sparky. You know, you got Sparky, you know, calling the shots there. Roger Craig is your pitching coach. And, of course, you've got the late, great Ernie Harwell calling the action from Tiger Stadium. I mean, can you just imagine, you know, you get to experience that? Of course, that's all, you know, again, hindsight being 2020. But I'm just curious. Tell me your answer at Wax and Gum Stains. If you won that World Series trip, would you go to games one and two of the 83, games three and four of the 83, or the 84 World Series? And I guess it's just really, you know, what team are you a fan of? You know, would you like to you know, go to Old Memorial Stadium and see a young Cal Ripken and that Orioles team? Would you go to Veterans Stadium and see the Wheez kids, you know, the overachieving 83 Phillies? Or like me, Tiger Stadium, 84. Or, hey, maybe you want to go to San Diego. Go to the Murph. Padres are wearing those old taco brown and gold jerseys, and it's Steve Garvey and Goose Gossage and all the crazy assorted fruits and nuts of the 84 San Diego Padres team. But that would be interesting. I'd be curious to hear what you'd have to say with that. But if you had three home runs, then you won the trips to the World Series. If you got three triples, you won. Are you ready for this? A ColecoVision video game system and Donkey Kong cartridge. Now, for some people in 1983, that was the grand prize. Screw the World Series. Just give me the ColecoVision set. And of course, you know, if you're under the age of 30, you have no idea how cool home video game systems were back then. This is before the Nintendo system. This is before Sega Genesis. And of course, you know, way before Sony and, you know, what we have nowadays with, you name it, you know, starting with Wii and Xbox and everything else, you know, Switch and all the others that you have now. You know, it was bare bones back then. If you were one of the rich kids, you had an Atari. If you were one of the lucky kids, you had ColecoVision. If you were like the rest of us, you had the Odyssey 2000, which was brutally simple but fun at the same time. And having the game cartridges and the little you know, toggle switch panels and the joysticks, man, those were the days. So, hey, maybe you don't luck out and get one of the 1 in 20 million odds of winning the World Series tickets. But if you were one of the 100 winners with the 1 in 400,000 chances to win the ColecoVision game system and Donkey Kong cartridge, that, my friend, was a pretty good prize. Now, the other prize is not so shabby here. Three doubles equals a baseball batting glove. And three singles, you got a Topps mini baseball card sheet of 82 liters. I've got to see if there's any of those out there. I wonder if anybody cashed in on those and hung on to them. And then the bonus prize, you got runs here. If you collect 25 runs, you could choose one of 8 collector edition 5-card sets. So basically, you would collect all of these little prize cards and mail them in to Topps with shipping and handling, and you got this little set of cards here. So I actually scratched off the cards here, and I did not win, and my bonus runs were 2. So on average, I would have to buy 13 more cello packs to get this wonderful prize. I do believe these were included in wax packs as well. But the ingenious marketing effort, too, of Topps here, where I would have to at least buy 13 more of their products to get a chance. So, you know, think about it. The cello packs, which were 49 cents back in the day, so I would have had to spend, $14 on cello packs and throw in an additional 50 cents to pick up the 5-card collector set. Genius marketing by Topps there. Some people actually collect the scratch-off cards. You know, I didn't mind scratching off this one because one of the bubbles that you scratch off had a scratch through it, just a packaging error. So I guess not technically in mint condition here. But some people actually collect those. I don't. I think that's minutia of collecting. But I've actually hung on to them, and they just they tend to be set separators in my big old monster box. You know, just separates the cards from one product to another. But a neat thing from the past. So that was pretty fun to check out. It was also pretty fun to check out some of the cards that I did get. And I want to go through some of the players that we got in the pack, starting with Bruce Sutter. And we've had Sutter in some other pack breaks before, but I love telling the story of Bruce Sutter because he is one of the relief pitchers, a closer that often gets left in the dust of history. And he was actually a trendsetter in many ways. Now, when you think back of closers, often the first name you think of is Raleigh Fingers, because Raleigh Fingers was one of the first of many designated closers. Once the save became an official stat in baseball in 1969, Raleigh and the A's were such a dominant machine in this time that most people think of Raleigh Fingers as like the first closer. Well, he's maybe the first one you think of, but you know, you think of other players like Hoyt Wilhelm, you know, later on in his career was brought in to throw some garbage over the plate and win some games for teams that he played for. But Raleigh's the first one you think of, but Bruce Sutter was the first that was almost specialized as a closer from the very beginning. And it was thanks in part to arm injuries. He was drafted by the Washington Senators in 1970, very wisely chose not to sign with them, and became an undrafted free agent with the Chicago Cubs. And while he's going up through the Cubs farm system, he has these arm problems, and the problems were so bad, he had to change how he pitched. So he was limited in his usage. You know, managers could only bring him in for a couple of innings, but it also forced him to learn how to throw a split-fingered fastball or a forkball. And he mastered that in the minor leagues so much so that all the other Cubs pitching prospects are like, hey, you got to show me how you pitch that ball. And he turned that into a signature pitch that won him many awards, first with the Cubs, later with the Cardinals, and slightly with the Braves later on in his career. And I say slightly because he was a big money free agent after the 1984 season. Goes to sign with the Braves, and unfortunately for him, after the 85 season, starts developing major arm problems, and basically his tenure with the Braves petered out in the late 80s, and in fact, I think it was 89, the last year of his contract, he couldn't pitch for the Braves. His arm was so thoroughly shot that the Braves kept him on the roster, you know, kept him on the disabled list, but he didn't see any action with the team at the very end. Now, he was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2006. He picked up 76.9% of the vote and concluded his career with 300 saves, and by pure chance, the 300 save threshold kind of became the threshold for relief pitchers, in particular closers, in getting into the Hall of Fame. Now, there were other pitchers who had more saves than Bruce Sutter, in particular Dennis Eckersley and Lee Smith, and then those guys were just blown off the map by the Troy Percivals and Trevor Hoffmans and Mariano Rivera's of the time. But really, Bruce Sutter was the first closer to kind of set the bar, which others soon after, Eckersley, Smith, and of course Raleigh Fingers were able to top, and then you had the others down the line. So Rivera, Hoffman, and Percival, and all these others blowing past 300 saves, but it was Sutter that kind of set that mark there. So cool to see a guy who was able to overcome the injury situation, find some magic in that forkball, and then find his way to Cooperstown because of it. By the way, he had a son, Chad Sutter, catcher for Tulane, selected by the Yankees in the 99 draft. Never made it to the majors, however, had a nice little minor league career and became a coach with Tulane. And Sutter, over the last several years, has been a roving pitching coach for the minor league system of the Phillies. So a great story. Again, a guy who was able to persevere and find some success as a relief pitcher despite having numerous arm problems. Now, one of the cards that we pulled out of this pack, Bill Caudill, who was also a pretty darn good relief pitcher, but not quite in the status of Bruce Sutter, but ironically took over as the closer for the Cubs after Sutter left in a trade with the Cardinals. I'll leave it to the Cubs to give away an all-star relief pitcher. Go figure. But, you know, Bill Caudill became the closer for the Cubs in the early 80s, was then moved on via trade to the Mariners, later played out his career in Oakland and Toronto, trying to make a comeback with Oakland, but wasn't able to do it. He was an All-Star with the A's in 1984, and in the All-Star game, which was played in San Francisco, he struck out all three batters that he faced in the seventh inning. Listen to the three batters he struck out: Tim Raines, Ryne Sandberg, and Keith Hernandez. Not a bad trio to strike out in a key moment in the game. It was the seventh inning, and the National League was hanging on to a 2-1 lead at that point in time there. Now, while his All-Star exploits are, certainly statistically one of the highlights of his career, he was a little bit of a whack job too. But most notably, while he was with the Mariners, and the Mariners were such a train wreck in the early 80s, he kind of fit in. So I don't know if I should call the Mariners a train wreck from that time. They were more appropriately a shipwreck. And a great story from Bill Caudill's time in Seattle. In 1982, the Mariners had, instead of the usual bullpen golf cart, which most of the time in those days, the golf cart had this baseball-shaped outer body, and there was a big baseball cap on top with the team logo, and that's what teams use to drive their pitchers in from the bullpen. And bullpen carts are kind of sort of making a comeback. I know there's one in Arizona. I think some teams don't like the expense. They don't like the cart tearing up the field. Some players, they think they're too manly to get into the golf cart, so they don't want to do it. It is kind of making a comeback. But anyways, they were still a big deal back in the early 80s. Well, the Mariners, trying to be original, instead had a tugboat bullpen car. So it was, not this little golf cart. It was kind of it was almost like the stretcher cart that you see in football. It was a much bigger cart that would, was dressed up like a boat and would haul in the relief pitcher. Well, Caudill, on opening day in 82, stole the keys during the pregame festivities, drove the cart around, and left the cart in the left field line in the outfield, which delayed the start of a game. Also, during one lopsided Mariners loss, Caudill was called from the bullpen, and he came running out wearing half a beard. Yeah, he shaved half his beard, and he just came out and pitched with half a beard in the game. Nicknamed the Inspector, his warm-up music while he was warming up out of the bullpen was rather appropriately the Pink Panther theme, which was rather cool. Now, even though Caudill replaced Bruce Sutter as the closer for the Chicago Cubs, it would be a 180 later on in his career. He was brought into Toronto to be the closer for the Blue Jays in 1985, wasn't getting the job done. And then the Blue Jays acquired Tom Henke from the Rangers, and the rest, as they say, was history. Like I said, Caudill tried to make a comeback with the A's. He too dealt with some arm problems and wasn't able to do so. But quite the interesting story of Bill Caudill as a player. Now, even though he might have been somewhat of a whack job as a player, he's as crazy as a fox. He currently coaches and works for his former agent, Scott Boras, who is a teammate and friend of Caudill in the minor leagues. So the joke is on us with Bill Caudill. One of Caudill's teammates in the 1980s when he was, or excuse me, no, he wasn't a teammate. I should correct myself. They did both play for Toronto. Al Woods, that was one of the cards we pulled here, better known as Alvis Woods. That was his birth name. Alvis Woods, I've got a funny story about him. When my wife and I got married in 2006, we got married on April 15th. And we split our honeymoon. We had a full week-long honeymoon, but we split it between the Lake George region in upstate New York and Toronto. And I love both areas, two completely different areas to visit in one week, by the way. But I love visiting Toronto. Toronto is a great city. And by pure chance, when we were up in Toronto, the Blue Jays were playing the Red Sox. And the Blue Jays were not a very good team then. I know they're kind of back to not very good status now. But, they did have a few years that they were competitive prior to this current dry spell. But in 2006, I mean, they were on year, what, 10 of just bad baseball. They were not a very good team. And, you know, finding tickets to the Jays game was pretty easy to do. And in 2006, the Blue Jays were celebrating their 20th anniversary. Their 30th anniversary. Math is easy. So anyways, the Blue Jays are celebrating their 30th anniversary. They're not a very good team. So what do not very good teams do when they have a big round number anniversary to celebrate? They bring back all the old players. And you think back to 30 years of Blue Jay history at that time, and you think of the 92 World Series team, you think of the 93 World Series team, you think of the playoff teams in 85 and 89 and 91, you think of the original 77 team. So there's all sorts of options for players to bring back. Well, who do they bring back for the game that we attend? Al Woods. And Al Woods is like the last guy you think of, but he was so beloved by the Toronto fan base. He was an expansion day draft pick in 1976. He was originally drafted by the Expos, didn't sign, was later drafted by the Twins, and he was exposed by the Twins in the expansion draft. Well, the Blue Jays pick him up, and he was on the opening day roster. And he actually entered the game as a pinch hitter in the fifth inning. And he would hit a home run in his first at-bat on the first pitch that he saw. So he's not just this little footnote. He's actually a key part to the great story of the Toronto Blue Jays. First at-bat, first pitch off Francisco Berrios of the White Sox, if you were keeping score, goes deep and forever embeds himself in the hearts and minds of Blue Jays fans. So he was, a pretty decent player on a not so decent Blue Jays team all that time. Would later get traded to Oakland for Cliff Johnson, and he would get released during spring training that year. Re-signs with the Blue Jays, and basically spends the next several seasons in their minor league system. Doesn't get a chance to play again in Toronto. Goes back to Minnesota in the mid-80s and has a brief call-up in late 1986 and would retire after the season. But a story of perseverance as well. You know, an expansion team star in a team that did not have many stars and, you know, had to fight through the minor leagues for a few years before making his way back to the majors and playing with Minnesota. But I just, when I pull the Al Woods card, I just think back to that game I went to, you know, on our honeymoon. It's just like, really, Al Woods? But, you know, again, had that one shining moment in game number one, was a halfway decent player on a not-so-decent team for many years, and was just a good guy, too. The fans just really, really loved him. Now, here's another good guy who doesn't quite get the love he deserves, but could mash the ball. First in Boston, later in Milwaukee, and was unfortunately part of the downfall, the planned downfall of the Houston Astros as manager later on in life. Cecil Celester Cooper, or Coop as he's better known. This guy could absolutely mash. A college graduate of Prairie View A&M, better associated with Jerry Rice, is Prairie View A&M. But Cecil Cooper, who was traded for George Scott, was one of the many of Harvey's wall bangers, Harvey Keene's Milwaukee Brewers in the late 70s. And, later on, you know, with George Bamberger at the helm and other managers, he was a mainstay at first base for many years in the late 70s and then throughout the early 80s. Five-time All-Star, two-time Gold Glove Award winner, three-time Silver Slugger, the RBI leader for the American League twice in the early 80s, and a career 298 hitter with 241 home runs. This guy was just an absolute killer at the plate and quite the character as well. He held the team record for RBI in a season until 2009 when Prince Fielder passed him. But quite the player who then made his move up the minor league coaching ranks and became the bench coach for the Astros. He took over for Phil Garner late in the 2007 season and was himself released from his duties late in the 2009 season. This was just as the Astros were slipping backwards and then becoming one of the worst teams in the early 2010s, if you will. But as we all know now, that was part of the plan, as the Astros were able to stock up on top draft choices, draft and develop, and develop a team that became World Series champions in 2017. And even though they didn't win the World Series today, or this year, I should say, they were able to become a contender, and I think will be for several more years. A common card, but a not-so-common player I want to bring up real quickly, Jeff Lotti, or as he was known as Jeff Latida. He was a very casual pitcher, but a World Series champion in 1982 with the St. Louis Cardinals over Cecil Cooper's Milwaukee Brewers, a teammate of Bruce Sutter, who we were talking about before. He actually took over for Sutter in St. Louis when Sutter moved on to the Atlanta Braves. And much like Sutter and Bill Caudill, poor Jeff Lotti also had injuries to fight in 1986, and Todd Worrell would take over his role as the closer. And Worrell would perform rather well. But a rather strange story. I pulled this off Wikipedia. This is odd. In 2012, the acting governor of Michigan, incumbent Rick Snyder, reached out to the governor of Oregon, John Kitzhaber, with a proposition. Apparently, Snyder had watched Jeff Lotti play in the major leagues. He loved Lotti's personality. And Snyder proposed that a children's health clinic be named in honor of Lotti. And for some reason, he felt that Lotti's name being attached to it would inspire kids in Lotti's hometown of Oregon City, Oregon. Well, for one reason or another, the whole thing got scrapped and hasn't followed up since then. But, that's no disrespect to Jeff Lotti, but that's probably not the first name, kind of like Al Woods. Probably not the first name you think of getting associated with that. But still, even though Jeff Lotti had a very brief major league career, he only played in, I believe, just five seasons with that arm injury, derailing his career in the mid-80s. Found that kind of an odd story there, an interesting footnote to history. We also pulled a Gary Ward card. You know, Ward is a very underrated player. That was a very easy situation to find yourself in if you played for the Minnesota Twins in the early 80s, as they were rebuilding and stocking up for a pretty successful run in the late 80s and into the early 90s. But here, pictured with the Minnesota Twins, a team that he played for through 83, eventually got traded to the Texas Rangers, and that's where he had a little more of a spotlight on him. He was a two-time All-Star in 83 with the Twins and in 85 with the Rangers. He was the Rookie of the Year for the American League, as named by Baseball Digest, in 1981. And you think of some of the big rookies that came through Minnesota. You think of Ken Urbeck, and you think of Kirby Puckett, of course, and you think of, you know, Frank Viola, and some of the other names that came through at that time. You're probably not thinking of Gary Ward, but yeah, he was the first of many young players to come up through the system, and even though he wasn't part of that Twins team in 87 or 91, was part of that young core that they were trying to build something around. Now, he would go on to be a coach in the minor leagues for many, many years, and his son, Daryl, who you may recognize, played in the early 2000s. The Ward family is known for hitting for the cycle. So Gary Ward, the father, he hit for the cycle in his 14th at-bat. That is still, or excuse me, his 14th game. Correction there. So his 14th game, he hit for the cycle. That is still a major league record for fewest games played before hitting for the cycle. Now, his son also hit for the cycle. Yes, believe it or not, his son, Daryl, hit for the cycle in May of 2004. So the Wards are the first and only father-son combination in Major League history to hit for the cycle. How cool is that? How cool is it to see that Jerry Remy, again, is free of cancer? That guy, my goodness, Jerry Remy, the ultimate cheerleader for the Boston Red Sox, and I mean that in the kindest of ways. Color commentator for the Red Sox, played for the Red Sox in the early 80s, started his career with the Angels, but, you know, he's a New England boy, so he comes home, plays for the Red Sox, has a very successful career throughout his time, not only with the Angels, but the Red Sox, you know, career 275 hitter, quite the, durable second baseman for, what was that, I think 10 seasons he played in the big leagues. An all-star in 1978, part of the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame, as I mentioned, a color commentator for the team for many, many years. Also an author, but he's dealt with health issues. You know, he's been dealing with cancer off and on for the last 10 years. And to put it nicely, family issues, my goodness. I remember hearing this story. All three of his children have had run-ins with the law. His son, Jared, was arrested in the fatal stabbing of his girlfriend back in 2013. He pled guilty in 2014 and is in state prison for that. His other son, Jordan, was drafted by the Red Sox in 1999. In 2010, he was charged with indecent assault and battery. And then his daughter, Jenna, in 2013, was arrested for disorderly conduct, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, resisting arrest, wanton malicious defacement, and misdemeanor breaking and entering after she broke into her home or broke into the home of her ex-boyfriend. So think about this. This is crazy. So in 2010, son Jordan is charged with indecent assault and battery. July of 2013, the daughter has that litany of charges. In August of 2013, Jared is charged with stabbing his girlfriend. All the while, Jerry Remy is fighting cancer off and on, which is just absolutely insane. So, Jerry Remy, I am so glad that he is healthy, because at least he's got that. And hopefully we'll be back in the booth for the Red Sox in 2019. And we're going to wrap up the thoughts on these players' cards with just a couple of thoughts about some Hall of Famers. Alan Trammell, finally, rightfully, in the Hall of Fame. And yes, Lou Whitaker should be there. I mean, listen to some of the stats with Trammell and Whitaker. I mean, Trammell already has... Yeah, he certainly qualifies for the Hall of Fame with his statistics, and never mind his managing record or coaching record. You know, he was thrust into the Tigers, manager's seat in 2003 just for goodwill, because that was the Tigers team that eventually lost 119 games. But with Sweet Lou Whitaker, holds the American League record for playing together, 1,918 games. They also set the Major League record for turning most double plays. That's the most for any shortstop second baseman combination in baseball history. And they also twice won Gold Gloves together. There's only a duo of eight shortstop second baseman combinations who have that same honor. And they both won it in the 83 and 84 seasons. So, yes, if Alan Trammell is good enough to be in the Hall of Fame, Lou Whitaker should be there. Those guys were attached at the hip going back to, I think, 1977, when they were in the minor leagues. They were a combination, and they were so up through the early 1990s. And a career average of 285. 2,365 hits, over 1,000 RBI, six-time All-Star, four-time Gold Glove Award winner, and again, attached to the hip of Lou Whitaker. Lou should be in Cooperstown. And no doubter, a guy in Cooperstown, Michael Jack Schmidt. You know, it's so funny. Every time I pull a Mike Schmidt card, I think of Harry Callis, the late, great Harry Callis. Michael Jack Schmidt. I can't quite do the Harry Callis impression there. I do have, quick sidebar, I do have a great Harry Callis story. Many years ago, I was in Clearwater. I was covering the Phillies and Devil Rays spring training game for the radio station I was working with at the time. And the way that the baseball field is arranged in Clearwater, the press box area, if you go out the press box and make a right, there's a bathroom there. But it's not just the press box bathroom. It's a bathroom for that part of the grandstand. So the general public's going in there. Well, after the game, I have to go to the bathroom. So I walk in there and I go up to the urinal and I'm doing my business. Well, right next to me is a fan. And next to him is Harry Callis. And Harry was just the most approachable guy you could meet. And this fan sees that Harry Callis is standing next to him. Says, "Oh, Harry, how are you?" "I'm fine. How are you?" He says, "Oh, I'm great. You know, I grew up listening to you." And, you know, he's telling stories. And, you know, Harry's playing. "Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. I'm glad you could be here to watch the game." And then there's a little bit of silence. And the guy goes, "You look like you've lost weight, Harry." And Harry goes, "Oh, I have. I stopped smoking." What? And I'm standing there. I'm like, what is this guy doing? You know, don't give Harry Callis the one over while you're at the urinal, for Christ's sake. Come on. I think he was seeing if Harry Callis had a Harry Callis somewhere. But anyways, so Michael Jack Schmidt. Phenomenal player, of course. speaking of, you know, giving players a one over, Pete Rose once marveled at the chiseled stature of Mike Schmidt, was once said to have his body, I'd trade him mine and my wife's and I'd throw in some cash. Of course, Pete probably knew what the odds were about that. Mike Schmidt was scouted out ever since his Little League days, believe it or not. He was a star player for Ohio, led the Bobcats to the College World Series in 1970, and was selected 30th overall in the second round by the Phillies in 1971. The Phillies were very smart, though, not rushing him up, made him mature through the minor leagues, and he would make his debut late in the 1973 season. And they were able to be sold on Mike Schmidt so early in his career that the Phillies traded their all-star third baseman Don Money to Milwaukee. Of course, that helped the Brewers out. But Schmidt, of course, started off a phenomenal career at the hot corner, hit over 500 home runs, tearfully retired early in the 1989 season. He just got off to a slow start, couldn't maintain, you know, all of his greatness that he had compiled up until that point, and had to call it quits early in the 89 season. But he was such a fan favorite, even outside of Philadelphia. This is such a great story. He was still voted by the fans to start the 1989 All-Star Game at third base. The game was played in Anaheim that year. And even though Schmidt was retired, he wanted to thank the fans. He took part in the pregame ceremony where, you know, they announced the starting lineup. So he went out there in full uniform and you know, doffed the cap to the fans, but he didn't play in the game. But I thought that was rather classy. Schmidty, of course, has been working his way up through the management ranks, coaching ranks as well. Briefly served as the manager of the Clearwater Threshers, that of course the Phillies farm club here in Clearwater, Florida, but that was just for the 2004 season, and resigned. And he's fortunately been able to fight through a cancer diagnosis as well. He had stage 3 melanoma back in 2013, but he is now cancer-free and has been ever since then. But that's the story of Michael Jack Schmidt. Not that you need too many stories of Schmidty, but certainly the key cog, the cornerstone of that 1980 World Series champion Phillies team, but also some of the great Phillies teams in the late 70s and that 1983 pennant winner as well. Well, that'll wrap up, speaking of 1983, our talk about the 83 Tops set and the cards that we pulled. 83 Tops, because of the Sandberg, Boggs, and Gwynn rookies, priced a little higher than some of the other cards from that time, but still very easy to get. I got a trio of these cellos Might have overpaid a tad bit on eBay, but I got three of them with shipping for $30, which in my opinion is not bad. $10 a cello pack is actually a pretty good deal. And you can still find some pretty good deals out there. And if you don't mind shelling out a few extra bucks for those three rookie cards, as well as a little bit more for the Ripken second year card, the 83 top set is an absolute winner. Might cost you $200 or $300 to put it together, but I think it's worth every penny. It's just a great set, and I'm glad that through our election, we were able to pick this particular set. All right, again, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Friday, November 30th, our next podcast will come out. We'll talk about another pack that we open up and the cards that we find inside of it. Remember, if you would like to help us do a little pack shopping, we could use your financial support at paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you make a cash donation, it goes into the purchase of cards as well as the maintenance of our podcast and the archives as well through Audio Boom and all of our other channels, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for checking us out. We'll see you next time on Wax Ecstatic.